when I was a boy. One of my favorite movies, and also the one that probably disturbed me most, was an early Disney film called Old Yeller. Now, typically, when I mention that in a mixed audience, all the men get tears in their eyes, because Old Yeller is a really sad movie, because it's about a boy and his dog, and the dog is incredible, and at the end of the movie, the dog dies. That should have given a spoiler alert on that, but the dog dies. And when I was a boy, I just couldn't understand that. Why did Old Yeller have to die? Surely they could have done something to save that dog. And then, as an adult, I realize it's still a sad movie, but it is understandable. Rabies, which is what Old Yeller gets, is 100% fatal once symptoms appear. Once a dog has symptoms, it's fatal. Never, never will it recover. And the killing of Old Yeller actually becomes an understandable act. It's to save the dog from further misery and difficulties. There's a quote I want to read for you from Richard Dawkins in his book, The God Delusion. I will tell you, it's very harsh language, and I don't apologize for it, because I think you need to hear the vitriol with which some people speak about God. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. Richard Dawkins said that. And he said that largely because of the subject we're going to study right now. Preaching the bloody gospel. What about God ordering the genocide of all those nations around Israel? I fear that Richard Dawkins is viewing God like I did Old Yeller as a boy. I think he's misunderstanding some of the intent and consequences of not taking action or taking the action that was taken in that particular movie. What about all that genocide? What about the slaughter of all those people? What about killing men, women, children, horses, camels, lambs, goats, rams, flocks, burning everything? What about that? Is that the actions of a loving God, a forgiving God, a God of mercy and grace? Can we reconcile those things? And I want to say this. I think it's been very easy for me personally to explain the two stories that we've looked at already. I have no problem at all explaining the story of Lot's wife or explaining the story of Uzzah and the ark. But I will tell you, this one is deeper. This one is heavier. And rather than tell one story like I've been able to do so far, and we'll be able to do again tomorrow, Unlike that, this one requires, I think, dissection. Let's take the topic, and I'm going to give you several ways of looking at that subject with this hope in mind. I don't know that everyone will hit your hot button. I think I may make one argument, and you may say, rightly so, you may say, nah, I don't know that I buy that one. And that's all right. That's okay. But I do think if you take all the ways we're going to look at this subject, that you will find something in this that will satisfy your concerns and anxiety about this matter of genocide in the Bible. So give it some consideration with me, and let's talk about it. And this topic has a particular relevancy to our culture today that none of our other topics will have. I think you'll see that pretty quickly. Number one, I've got just a couple of ideas for you. And first is this. We cannot limit God to our status. You can't reason in this matter as if the way we look at it is the way God should look at it. I think that we make that mistake. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. A mainline denomination recently excluded the song In Christ Alone. You sing that here? In Christ Alone? They excluded that from their songbook because of the phrase, "And on that cross where Jesus died, the wrath of God was satisfied." And they could not reconcile the phrase, "the wrath of God," with the God they understood or believed in. Their God couldn't be wrathful. And so they just took the song out altogether. Now, rather than trying to argue with them that they're doing the right thing because they simply don't understand it, or that they misunderstand wrath altogether, I think the way to approach that particular incident is to understand that wrath for God is not a flaw. It is for us. I mean, none of us would say, if I were to ask the question, I'm not asking you to raise your hands, but if I were to say, how many of you have a lot of wrath, you'd probably not raise your hands. Or if you did, you would raise it as if I'm confessing it. Not that, yep, that's me, like, how many of you like football? Or how many of you like skating? It's not that kind of, yeah, I do. It would be more a, yeah, I do, and I wish I didn't. Because wrath, for most of us, is a bad trait. It's an indication that we can't control ourselves, that we've reached the point where we've blown our tops, we're past being reasonable, and our wrath, most of the time, manifests itself in very ungodly behavior. Whether it's the way we talk, or the way we treat other people, or the way we may react even physically. Wrath is that way for us. Wrath is not that way for God. Wrath is not, I've lost it, I can't take it anymore. It's not that with God. He does not react that way. When our God reacts with wrath, it is a controlled and very deliberate reaction to evil. So the people that said the wrath of God was satisfied, We can't sing that because that doesn't fit our understanding of God, probably need to revisit their understanding of wrath. Now, that has an impact for us. Because you see, what I'm suggesting we do with God is the same thing we do with a lot of other aspects of our culture. I used this illustration once, but I think it fits very well. If I were to pull out a knife and go over to Tony and cut in the side of his face, he would probably be very upset, and he might even have me arrested for doing that. A friend of mine sent me a picture of himself, and he had this terrible scar, gash down the side of his face, and it had been sewn up. And he sent it to me, and I immediately went to my wife, and I said, "Look, look at this picture. Look what happened to Mark." And Paula looked at it, and it was horrible. She said, "Oh, goodness, what happened? What is that?" And I said, "A guy with a mask came into the room where he was and sliced his face." And Paula said, "Where in the world did that happen?" I said, "It was in a doctor's office." Yeah, you chuckled. My wife didn't. Paula was really mad at me about that. She said, "That is not funny." So I tried it a few more times, and it wasn't funny to other people either. So I quit doing that. But it does illustrate what I'm talking about. You see, if when she thought it's just a guy who walked in there and slashed him, that was horrible. When she finds out it's a doctor who's come in there to remove a precancer from his cheek, then what do we all do? Oh, okay, that's all right. You see, we don't judge the doctor the way we judge ourselves. He has some knowledge and skills and reasons for doing what he's doing that make it okay. Right? We get that? We're the same way with police officers. We're the same way with other government officials. We say, well, they have a right to do that. They are authorized to do that, or they have reasons for doing that that we may not have. Judges, we give a judge the right to condemn somebody to death. But if I went out and on my own just grabbed somebody and put them in an electric chair, strapped them down and killed them, I'd go to jail. I don't have that right. Why does a judge have that right? He's like me in many ways, yes, but he has information and authority to do things I don't have the information or authority to do. And the same thing is true of God. It's like Old Yeller. It didn't make sense to me as a kid. Why would you shoot a wonderful, beautiful dog like that? But when you know more information, you realize that had to be done. And had to be done even for the welfare of the dog, that he doesn't suffer. God does things that we can't judge by our actions or our determinants. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I may think it's a bad thing, but God may say, "Ralph, you don't have the knowledge I have." I may say to the doctor, "Don't cut on me. I don't want to be cut." And he may say, "If I don't cut on you, terrible things are going to happen to you." We have limited knowledge. And I'm going to say, in the final analysis about all this, it may very well be that the best we can come up with is God has a right to declare the genocide of these cultures because he knows something we don't know. He has information and power we don't have. And far be it from me to judge him by my standards. I want to show you a passage. Go back to the book of Job. And it's very helpful to me that this is found at the beginning of the book, before Job's had a long conversation with God. In Job chapter 1, everything bad that is going to happen to him has happened, except the personal attacks on his body. But verse 21 says, Job said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And the New American Standard says, "Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God." Now, that word for blame literally means did not ascribe unseemliness to God. He did not accuse God of doing something improper. That's wise. We need to be really careful about calling God names like homophobic, genocidal, filicidal, infanticidal, pestilential. You better be careful about that because you're judging him on the basis of your knowledge, which isn't his. He sees things we don't see. He understands consequences we cannot understand. And we need to be very careful about him. Ours is a limited knowledge. And then I said to you, this lesson has some cultural implications that no other lesson in this series has. And I want to tell you what that is right now. We need to be very careful about letting our cultural mores determine what's right and wrong. We better make sure that when we determine right and wrong, it isn't based on what our culture has determined is right and wrong. You better be careful about that. Because, first of all, it's a chronological snobbery that says, we know now what other people did in the past was absolutely wrong, and they don't have the knowledge we have, and they don't have the morals we have, and they don't understand right and wrong like we understand it. Because when we start reasoning that way, you're going to have to explain to me how the pyramids were built. Go ahead, give it a shot. Because we still don't know how those things were built. With all of our abilities, we still don't know how those were built. So be careful about determining everything before us was not as good, not as knowledgeable, not as advanced as we are right now. And so we look back on some of these things that we're talking about here, and we judge those things by where we are today. We judge a past by our current standards. When I was a boy, I loved cowboys. I mean, I grew up in that era of cowboys. And if you could take, for you younger people, if you could take Han Solo and put spurs on him and put him on the back of a horse, you'd have a cowboy. I mean, that's the kind of people that I thought were just the coolest. But I need to be really careful about judging their wildness, their disregard for life, based on what I would do today, because I'm not in that culture. And again, I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying I don't have the wherewithal to judge it because I live in a different time and place. And it's not always better for us. The Victorian era had a whole different concept about death and dying than we do today. Was it wrong? Were they primitive? Did they not understand? No, it was different. And there are some things about that I think we could probably learn a great deal from. We need to be careful about judging previous generations by our standards. Now, I could probably make this point stronger in my urban culture of Tampa, Florida, where even around us is not a great agrarian climate. But if you saw a pig slaughtered and prepared, you might have a whole different attitude about bacon. I remember a young man who was a vegetarian, and I asked him, why are you a vegetarian? Is it a health thing? He said, no. I was in a gospel meeting one time, and the people said, hey, it's fall, and it's time for us to slaughter the pigs. And he said, I happened to go out there. I wish I'd never done it. He says, I can't eat meat since then. I've seen how it's made. If you think hamburgers originate in McDonald's freezers, you don't understand what goes into getting it to that sterile point where you're looking at it nicely packaged in a grocery store. Be careful about judging. That's horrible. That's wrong. Taking those animals' lives is wrong. It's wrong the way they do that. Be careful about judging those things because in many cases, we're the recipients and the benefit of those things. And we may not understand at all how it got to that point, but we like the end result. A bacon cheeseburger is pretty good. And both a pig and a cow made the ultimate sacrifice to provide that for us. So don't judge all things by your own experiences. Be careful about that. And that particularly holds true in this case where we're talking about war. You know, we engage in war today in a much different way than past generations have. There's a book called The Face of Battle in which the author poses the premise that we find war to be in some ways more acceptable than previous generations because in previous generations you had to face the person you were killing within 6 feet of them and take their life by hand. And now we're able to project a bomb or a missile. We can sit in the United States and send a drone all the way across the world and kill people, and nobody ever sees the blood and gore of that. It makes it somewhat sterile. And we look back at these other things and say, how primitive. That was the only way they had to wage the same war that we wage, but we find it maybe more acceptable because we don't see the consequences like they did. So we judge them as primitive, brutal, horrible at what they did, and yet we take many more thousand lives in our wars today than they did then. We can't limit God to our status. The second point, I want you to stay with me on this. Hyperbole exists in the Bible. Hyperbole is exaggerative language. And the Bible uses exaggerated language. And we should not determine by that somebody's lying. If I said to you, went to that football game recently, I'm telling you, there must have been 100,000 people there. And so you read the next day, there were 89,000 people there. Would you come back and say, Ralph, you liar. You're just a big, fat liar. There weren't 100,000 people there. We use terms like that all the time. We say, that thing cost hundreds of dollars. How many hundreds? Well, that's just a number. We just give large numbers like that to say it was big. And we don't judge each other by that to say, you're lying. You're lying. It wasn't exactly that. It wasn't 1,000. It was 998. You're a liar. We don't do that. Now, I'm going to show you from the Bible that the Bible uses hyperbole. And what it's meant to do is give us the impact of something, not the minutiae of that, not the details of that. It's not meant to be that. And we know that because we can determine from the passages themselves that it's hyperbole. Context and a wider reading of the Bible often reveal that. So here they are. Here are a few. Romans chapter 1, verse 8. Paul's writing to the Romans. The Roman Christians, not the Roman government, not the Roman army. Here's what Paul says. Romans 1, verse 8. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all because your faith is being proclaimed throughout the whole world. Now, do you really think that over the entire world, everybody knew about the Roman church, their faith, their particular faith? Is that a lie? No, it's not a lie. What is he saying? You're renowned. Everybody knows you. But he does not mean by everybody, every single person on the face of the earth. He doesn't mean that. He just simply means you've got a reputation. People know who you are, and they respect and honor your faith. Now, don't give up on me. I've got a number of these. Go back to Acts chapter 11. In Acts chapter 11, some prophets come down from Jerusalem to Antioch, and in verse 28, it says, one of them, named Agabus, stood up, and he began to indicate by the Spirit that there would certainly be listen to the wording, a great famine all over the world. And this took place in the reign of Claudius. All right, now, there's a famine that is happening all over the world. It's a worldwide famine. If that's true, that the famine is everywhere in the world, please explain verse 29. And in proportion that any of the disciples had means, each of them determined to send a contribution for the relief of the brethren living in Judea. If you knew a famine was going to affect this community, would you send food to people in Omaha? I don't think so. Not if you had a famine here. So did the famine not affect Antioch at all? Was it exempt? And if it was exempt, if Antioch was exempt, then did it happen over the whole world? Is it a worldwide famine? I think the point that's being made here, again, is there's going to be a severe famine. We use that kind of terminology all the time. They'll say, and this hurricane has ravaged the state of Florida. Is everybody in the state hurt by that? No. But it has been pretty widespread. So we use that kind of language. Go to 1 Samuel chapter 15. 1 Samuel chapter 15. I appreciate your turning in your Bibles. This is good. Look at verses 3 and 8. This is during the reign of Saul. Samuel says, go and strike Amalek. Utterly destroy. Listen to the words. Utterly destroy all that he has. Do not spare him. Put to death man and woman and child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Verse 8, he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. Now, ask you a question. After verse 8, if you read that literally, how many Amalekites are still alive? They're gone, aren't they? As a people, they're gone. And by the way, he does capture Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive. He spared him until Samuel comes along. Samuel hacks him up in little pieces. So at this moment, at verse 8, there's one alive, but he won't be alive for long. All the Amalekites utterly destroyed, it says. If that's to be taken literally, explain, please, chapter 27, verse 8. Now David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites and the Gerzites and who? The Amalekites. Where'd they come from? I thought they were utterly destroyed. I mean, I thought they were totally wiped out. Do we use that kind of language and not mean it literally? Oh, all the time. Mason played soccer today. He might have come home from that game, and when I asked, hey, Mason, how'd the game go? He might have said, we destroyed them. And I go, ooh, you'll get arrested for that. You destroyed them? Did you utterly destroy them? Yeah. Utterly destroyed them. What does that mean? What does that mean in that context? It means we beat them really bad. But it doesn't mean they killed them all. If Saul killed them all, how are they here? And don't stop there. Go to chapter 30. There are not only some of them there. Chapter 30 says, when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. There's not just a couple of them. There's enough of them to attack a city and destroy it. And then in 2 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 1, the non-existent Amalekites are there again. It came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites. So it wasn't just a couple of them. We don't use the word slaughter in terms of a couple of people. Slaughter is of a great body of people. They're there. So was that a lie back there in chapter 15? No. But it does mean Saul really went after them and took it to the Amalekites. But they're still alive when David comes. Joshua chapter 10, verse 40, says the Amalekites, it says the Canaanites were utterly destroyed. Joshua 10, verse 40, they are utterly destroyed. Joshua struck all the land, the hill country, the Negev, the lowland, the slopes of all the kings. He left no survivor, but he utterly destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. Is that literally true? Or is that hyperbole? Well, in chapter 14, verses 12 through 15, you've got Caleb saying to Joshua, "Now give me this hill country about which the Lord spoke on that day, for you heard on that day that the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. Perhaps the Lord will be with me and I'll drive them out as the Lord has spoken." And now we're talking even about this Anakim, this race of giants that Joshua supposedly destroyed. And here's Caleb saying they've got fortified cities. So my point again is that hyperbole exists. That sometimes when it says utterly destroyed, it doesn't mean there wasn't a single one left alive. It's not wholesale slaughter always. We have to determine by context what we're talking about here. Let me give you one more thought about that. In Exodus chapter 23, go back, stay with me. We're making the same point that we have to be careful about reading the language. In Exodus chapter 23, verse 23 says, "My angel will go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, Canaanites, Hivites, Jebusites, and Termites." No. Okay, I was just seeing if you were listening. That last one's not there. "And I will completely destroy them." I will completely destroy them. Now, if you read that and you didn't know anything else, you would determine all Hivites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, and Canaanites, and Jebusites are dead. They're going to be dead. God is going to kill them. But now look at verse 28. Same chapter. "I will send hornets ahead of you so that they will drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites before you. I'll not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I will drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land." Now, how is God going to destroy them? He's going to destroy them as a community of people in the land of Canaan. He's going to displace them. He's driving them out, not driving them in. He's not killing them all. He's driving them out of the land. Not all the Hivites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Canaanites were killed by Israel. Many of them were driven away, driven out of the land, and allowed to live. Be careful about these words that you don't attribute to them a limited definition that we don't use as limited definitions ourselves. You may say, how did that dinner go that you guys had? Man, I mean, we devoured it. Does that mean you didn't have any leftovers? Nothing left? Nothing? I mean, absolutely everything was eaten? Every last bit of everything? Even the Brussels sprouts? See, we use terminology, devour, destroy, utterly destroy, and we attribute meanings to it that the scriptures in themselves deny. We need to reconcile these things, and the best way I know to reconcile them is to say some of these are hyperbole. So, sometimes being slaughtered or destroyed means being driven out. In Deuteronomy chapter 9, verses 1 through 5, they are dispossessed. That's the word that's used there. They were dispossessed of the land, and that destroyed them as a people. If you don't have a homeland, you don't have a place to be, you're destroyed as a people. If all Americans were taken and placed in other countries, America is destroyed. That's what the Assyrians did to their enemies. They would come in and take them all and put them in another place so that the nation itself would not exist anymore. So this is the way of the Bible. Let me give you one more example, and I just want you to think about this. We sometimes talk about how the city of Jericho was utterly destroyed, that they killed everybody in the city of Jericho. And we probably imagine Jericho to be this thriving metropolis. I mean, it's big enough to have its own McDonald's and Walmart and 3 traffic lights. We think of it as a big city. Have you ever thought about this? It's a walled city, so it has very clear definitions. It's walled. The Israelites marched around that city all the way around the outside of it 7 times in one day. How big could it be? How big could it be? They're not running marathons. These are soldiers, and they're being led by the Ark of the Covenant, so the poor priests can't run with that thing. They went around it 7 times in one day. 7 times, a marching army in one day. And they're not marching right outside the wall, because if they had, the people of Jericho would have dropped stuff on them. They're far enough away that they can't be shot with arrows. So put them that far away from the city walls, march them all the way around it. How many miles could they go 7 times in one day? I'm telling you, Jericho's a very small citadel. It's not a big thriving city with all kinds of schools and public buildings and libraries and parks. And the Israelites went in there and wiped them all out. It's a fortified citadel of a very limited size for the Israelites to be able to go around it 7 times in one day. You couldn't get around the outside perimeter of La Vista probably in a day if you walked all the way around the outside edges of it. So sometimes we paint pictures. Nobody said how big Jericho was. But we have this picture, must have been pretty big, must have had thousands and thousands of people. And the Israelites went in and wiped them all out. What a slaughter. It may not have been that big at all. It may have been a fairly small place. Be careful about judging Bible stories with definitions of words the way we give them or think about them. Third point, Justice is demanded by God. Not all the wars that were fought by Israel were encouraged by God. Not all of them. They fought wars that God did not approve of. And I'm not going into a lot of detail about it, but I'll simply recommend to you, you go back and look at 1 Samuel chapter 8. When the people want a king, and Samuel says, what do I tell them? God says, tell them this. Tell them, you're going to have a king. You're going to have a king who is going to take your sons, and he is going to make them soldiers and wage war for his benefits. God wasn't in that. God wasn't in all those wars. Sometimes we read about some of the wars that took place in the Bible, and God may not have had anything at all to do with it. We may not be able to blame him at all. He may not have been in it from the beginning. But he says, that's a curse for you Israelites. That's a curse if you take on a king. There are times God wanted to be merciful. He does want to extend mercy. He is not saying, you're my enemy or the enemy of my people. Wipe them all out. In Ezekiel chapter 33 is this beautiful statement. Ezekiel 33 and verse 11. Say to them, as I live, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but rather that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn back. Turn back from your evil ways. Why then will you die, O house of Israel? This is the heart of God. That's why he sent Jonah to Nineveh. Nineveh. It's the capital of the Assyrians. They're one of the most brutal nations in the history of the world. And Jonah was sent to turn them back. You say, well, did Jonah really, was he sent to turn him back? That's why he didn't want to go, because he knew God was merciful. Why would you send a message to warn them they're going to be destroyed unless you're trying to turn them from that? Why warn them at all? In Genesis chapter 15, verse 16, is a statement made to Abraham. Genesis 15, verse 16. God says to him, you're going to go and your people are going to be strangers in a land that's not theirs. And then I'm going to bring you back to this land and I'm going to give it to you to occupy, because he says the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. That's a very telling statement, folks. What that says is God destroyed the Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hittites, Hivites, Jebusites, because they had reached a point of full iniquity. Only then does God send in his judging forces. God waited 400 years for that to be meted out. He waited 120 years in the days of Noah, with Noah preaching righteousness. Yet pockets of those people are still spared because they turned to God. Some of those people turn to God. The Gibeonites make a covenant with Israel and they're spared. Why? Why? Because God had sent word ahead of them that he was coming. If you look at Joshua chapter 3, verses 8 through 13, the very first thing that crosses the Jordan River to go into the land of Canaan is the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is sent ahead. And what did Rahab say? You remember what she said? We have heard about you. What turned her heart to them? We've heard about you. What turned the heart of the Gibeonites to make peace with them? We have heard about you. Word went throughout the land. God would extend peace to those who were willing to be peaceful with the Israelites. Rahab is spared. The Gibeonites are spared. This idea that anybody that wasn't an Israelite and got in their way was wiped out and destroyed to the last person is not true. But God did use Israel to judge the wickedness of people around them. So you go to Leviticus 18. I'm running out of time, but I want to give you these. So I'm not going to read all this, but I want to give you this information. In Leviticus chapter 18, God says, don't be like the nations around you. Do not become like them. What is true of them? Listen, here's what the Canaanites were like. They're described in that Leviticus 18. They are, in verses 6 through 18, guilty of every kind of incest. They intermarry in their families, brothers marrying sisters, mothers marrying sons. This is the kind of disgusting sexual relationships that these people are having. Adultery is rampant, verse 20. They don't even recognize marriage. They'll sleep with whomever they want to. Verse 21, they're offering child sacrifices. They are sacrificing their children. Their children to the god Molech. Verses 22 and 23, homosexuality is rampant. Bestiality is rampant among the Canaanites. And verses 24 through 30 say, these were all practices of the Canaanites. Why did God do this? He is a just God. He will not live with that. And not only is that true of them, but Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 18 says, they are influences for evil among the Israelites. They're going to corrupt you. It's not just what they do. Now we're back to the idea, old Yeller had to die because he may have bitten his owner. When you got rabies, you're not only infected yourself, but you are infectious. And you may cause great harm to somebody else. Let me give you one example of the difference in the civilized destruction of their enemies and the uncivilized, wanton desecration of the enemies. In Joshua chapter 10, I'm going to look at this real quick with you. Joshua chapter 10. I want you to look with me at verses 24 through 27. When they brought these kings out to Joshua, Joshua called for all the men of the house of Israel and said to the chiefs, come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings. So they came near and they put their feet on their necks. And Joshua said, don't fear, don't be dismayed, be strong and courageous, for thus the Lord will do to all your enemies with whom you fight. So he struck him and put him to death. And he hanged them on five trees. And they hung on the trees until evening. But it came about at sunset, Joshua gave a command. They took him down from the trees. They threw him into the cave, and they put large stones over the mouth of the cave to this very day. They killed him, and they made an example of him, but only till sunset. Then they took him down, and they buried him. Contrast that with 1 Samuel chapter 31, where the Philistines beat the Israelites on the Mount of Gibeah, and they take Saul, and they recognize him as the king, and they cut his head off, and they cut his hands off, and they carried him back and paraded him that way through the town. And then they went and nailed his body to the wall outside the city, and they left it there indefinitely. They weren't going to take it down at all. And some Israelite heroes go and pull the nails out and rescue the body of Saul and take it and give it a proper burial. Israelites didn't do that. They were not guilty of that kind of wanton slaughter. In the Neo-Assyrian annals of Ashurnasirpal, they describe, this is 883 to 859 BC. This is during the time of the Israelites. Those annals describe flaying skin off of captured armies while they're alive. They impaled them. They heaped bodies up for show. They placed heads in piles. They gouged out eyes. They cut off ears. And they cut off limbs. This was the way of war with other nations. God's warriors never did that. What about the idea of killing women and children? Why would the Israelites have been commanded at all to kill any women and children? And I just want to suggest this to you. And again, don't judge this by our culture today. Women were often leavening agents for cultures. You remember the story in Numbers chapter 25 where Balaam incites their enemies to go and infiltrate the Israelites and intermarry with them so that they'll do what? Become idolatrous. Did they do that? Oh, absolutely. And in the days of Solomon, what was it that caused Solomon's downfall? Marriage with foreign women. Women have that kind of power in that culture to influence a departure from God. And what about children? Well, first of all, in many cases, children are not likely to be found in large numbers in fortified cities. But in Numbers 31, it's not all children, it's only male children that are killed. Now, you may say, oh, great, Ralph, so that makes it better. Well, it does make it a little more understandable because you don't want boys growing up to be soldiers who can take the lives of your own people. The women in that culture didn't fight. Let the girls live, but the boys won't live. Again, am I saying this is the way we always ought to wage war? Not at all. But there is some reason to it. It is not just wanton destruction of everybody. That doesn't happen often. But even in that culture, if children were spared and they were foreign children, they're likely to grow up orphaned. They may suffer as outcasts among Israel's people. If they die as children, there is one thing that's certain, and I'm convinced of this. If they die as children, they will die saved. They're innocent. They're not sinners. If they grow up in that culture that we've been talking about, if that's what they have known, they don't stand a chance. Let me give you one last point and we're done. One last point. In all the things we've talked about, the one thing we haven't really discussed is the inconsistencies of those who attack us for this Bible. They say, that's so brutal. I mean, that's so horrible that a God would allow people to do that kind of thing and even order them to do that. Why, this is against everything that humanity stands for. Really? Really? Then why don't you take a moment and justify the abortion of 53 million children in this country? Just take a minute and justify that for me, will you? You who say this death of these people in the Bible was wrong. In 2011, 1.06 million abortions took place in the U.S. Now, that was really good because it was down from an estimated 1.21 million in 2008, 1.29 million in 2002, 1.31 million in 2000. 1.36 million in 1996. From 1973 to 2011, 53 million legal abortions took place in the U.S. Now, who do you think is most likely to say that's okay? Christians? Followers of Jesus Christ? The very people who say, I don't believe the Bible. I don't believe it because it's so brutal. Tell me about brutality. Tell me about abortion. And that is not an isolated unbelief. I'm convinced if we could satisfy these objections in this one matter, it wouldn't bring us any closer together. These people generally disbelieve in hell. They disbelieve in heaven. They disbelieve in salvation. They disbelieve in condemnation because they disbelieve in God. This one issue is not the only issue that matters. It's one that we ought to think about. It's one that we ought to be able to reason about. But it's not the ultimate problem people have with the Bible. That's a lot of material. You have been so patient. You've been so kind to listen well. I appreciate that. I hope this helps you somewhat. One or more of those may make an impact on your life. Lord allowing, we'll come back together again tomorrow. We'll look at three more of the problem areas that we may have. We're going to look at Noah and the flood. Somewhat similar to what we've talked about today in terms of mass destruction. But we'll also talk about the story of Elisha and the 42 boys and the she-bears. And then tomorrow afternoon, Nadab and Abihu and the story that we find about them in Numbers chapter 10. I'm going to sing another song of encouragement for you. And if there's something at all that we can do for you or with you to see you come to a deeper, better relationship with God, let us know what that is, would you? Just don't leave this place before you let us know how we can help. Let's stand and sing the song.